with my girl. That's fine, I know I'm all pretty well, but I know sometimes I must get on.
Welcome to the Tom Dupree Show. You know, Tom is always looking for interesting guests, and we've got one today. We've got Christopher Larkin, who is, he works for the largest Bible smuggling organization in the world. You will not want to miss this one, so without further ado, here's our host, Tom Dupree.
So we're coming to you from an undisclosed location in an undisclosed state. Let your imagination run wild. You'll never guess. I'm going to read the Psalm. Psalm 66. Make a joyful noise unto God, all ye lands. Don't turn it all the way down. Come on, keep it playing. Sing forth the honor of his name. Make his praise glorious. Say unto God, how terrible art thou in thy works. Through the greatness of thy power shall thine enemies submit themselves unto thee. All the earth shall worship thee and shall sing unto thee. They shall sing unto thy name, Selah. Come and see the works of God. He is terrible in his doing toward the children of men. All right. Turn it up a little bit, honey. Okay. That's Psalm 66, verses 1 through 5. I want to talk a little bit about that song. If you look at the group there called The Who, that song probably came out in the early 60s. At the same time, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, the Kinks, the Dave Clark Five, And the reason I remember this is because when I was in the second grade, Johnny Merritt and I used to go back to his house, and we'd listen to his brother's 45s, and he had the Beatles, the Kinks, the old Who records. They were all 45s, so, you know, it's just one song on there. We'd sit and listen to them. It's about 1963-64. And the type of music that these guys all came from was a thing called skiffle. And skiffle was just that sound. I mean, it was kind of a club sound in London. And it was what they all did. So they all sounded alike back then. And then they began to diverge. You know, the Beatles kind of went their direction. So the Rolling Stones, more bluesy kind of thing. The Who, just different rock and roll sounds. And, you know, Peter Townsend busted guitars as kind of his trademark. Anyway, it's interesting. I love the music. As you know, we always will talk a little bit about music. Okay, so our friend Chris. I've gotten to know Chris basically because he's with an organization that we trust and enjoy, supporting and kind of knowing what they're doing throughout the world. And it isn't just Bible smuggling. It is a conduit through which help goes out to people in the world that are being persecuted severely for their faith. I don't think most people in the United States realize the great duress that some Christians throughout the world, not only some, but many, are enduring just for the fact that they are Christians and want to practice their faith. And these guys, this organization, and we're purposely not disclosing the name right now simply because there's something going on that could be sensitive to people who are working in some of these countries. So we purposely keep it mum, if you will. But these guys are like the State Department. They know the political situation in numerous countries, especially the ones that tend to be sort of rough on people of faith. So, Chris, I want to thank you for being on the show. And you, too, before you got into this work, you had a musical background. You've been involved in music. And, we thought, well, we'd talk a little bit about your musical career at the beginning, and then we could get into more of what you do.
Thanks, Tom. I'm so happy to be with you and to be with Elizabeth and to have this conversation. We've been talking about doing this for a while now.
Yep.
And it's been such a joy to get to know you. I'm a fan of the show. I'm excited to be here.
I'm glad you're here. And we had to work it out with his agent. It was not easy. The money, we finally got it worked out. And so, we're trying to take care of him here now. Seriously, it's just been, we've thought about doing this for a while and it hadn't happened, but now it is.
I said to be on the Tom Dupree show, I will lower my honorarium.
We appreciate it. And the listeners do too. They're going to enjoy it. So you started out in life, as a kid living in Chicago. Your dad was a pastor. You had an interest in music, I guess, from early on.
Yeah, I was born into a musical family. In fact, my dad was in a band. My mother and father were in a band. They started in college. They were saved in the Jesus movement of the late 60s, early 70s, and I was born in 1971, right in the middle of it. In the first 6 years of my life, before we started to settle down, I traveled with the band, the Good News Circle, all around the United States.
How would you describe the genre of the music?
Before they really grew and became an international band, it was my dad and his college roommate. They called themselves Christopher and Solon. Okay. And they were like a Simon and Garfunkel.
Okay.
They played bars and in small clubs, acoustic guitars. Yeah. And then my dad learned about Jesus. He met my mom, courted her. She said that she wouldn't date anyone who wasn't a Christian. Uh-huh. And so he became a Christian that day.
Yeah.
He went and found the only Christian he knew, and he's like, hook me up, bro. Tell me about this. And when he gave his life to Christ, his passion became Jesus. Uh-huh. And most of his songs, like Simon and Garfunkel, were love songs, right?
Sure.
And his passion for Jesus grew inside of him, and he started writing love songs for Jesus. Oh. And they added a percussionist who became a drummer. They added a bass guitar and a lead guitar. And the band grew. In fact, the band was so big and so in demand, they created a second band. There was the Good News Circle, the primary band, and then the Sunshine Circle, so they could cover multiple states at a time.
So this thing was a real enterprise, if you will. I mean, they probably had booking agents and everything like that.
It was a big deal. They opened for Billy Graham crusades.
Oh my
gosh.
So
we're talking about stadiums of people with thousands of people coming forward to accept Christ for the first time,
yeah,
or rededicate their lives, or dedicate their lives to the ministry. My dad's band would open for Billy Graham, and then they would make themselves available down front when people came forward to share Jesus with them.
I'm just pulling it up. They got several songs up on YouTube.
Yeah.
There's a fan club on Facebook for the Good News Circle. So they were the real deal.
Real deal. And my sister Holly and I, as children, grew up backstage there. And I remember several artists being back there with my dad. I remember Kris Kristofferson being there.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not kidding. I was told Bob Dylan was there multiple times. You know, he there was a time where he was professing Jesus.
Yes.
So several artists got caught up in this movement. It really was a movement. When they would sing, you could feel a spirit sweep across the crowd.
Yeah.
And it, the way music does, it unified.
Sure.
It unifies people.
You remember a group called Love Song back then? Chuck Gerard and I'm trying to think of the other guy. Well, Phil Keaggy was in that group for a while. You know, everybody knows who he is. But I just wondered if you ever heard about that.
I didn't.
Okay. Well, anyway, that's fine.
You
flunked that one. But
so my parents were very idealistic. And being the firstborn, I think the firstborn child and maybe the second one as well,
yeah,
really bear the brunt of that idealism.
Yeah.
So we were born into a home.
Tell me about it. I'm number one also.
First birth order?
It's a good thing that we're walking around.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. Go ahead.
So in our home, which was, we were like Christian hippies, you know? My dad had long hair and a handlebar mustache.
Sure.
And We didn't have a radio in the house. We didn't have a television in the house. We grew up telling each other stories, and there were musical instruments in the house. So we played music, but we never listened to music. They really didn't want those outside voices coming inside at that time.
Sure.
And tried to maintain the innocence of their children as long as they could. Whether that was a good idea or not remains to be seen.
But, so nobody was slipping some ZZ Top onto the record player or Alice Cooper or, you know.
In secret later on. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, now you had a musical career of your own.
Yeah.
And indeed, you were in Nashville, Tennessee, in the music business.
Yeah.
For a while, and you know, rub shoulders with some of the top people down there, people like Amy Grant, mm-hmm, and others, mm-hmm, Michael W. Smith, and people along those lines. And you played music that would also be considered sort of non-gospel, mainstream type stuff. You were in a band and things. And, you know, there's actually some videos out there. The guy is a little bit hard to recognize based on the guy that I know today.
I had more hair back then.
Well, you had more. I don't know what you had. But anyway, so you had your own career. Talk about that a little
bit. Yeah. After I studied theology and philosophy in college. And everybody who had that major was going on to seminary. And I applied to three seminaries. I was accepted in all of them. And I decided I was going to go to Trinity in Deerfield, just outside of Chicago. And I was going to go there at the end of the summer. And I spent that summer playing in a band, traveling around the United States, doing small events. And then when it was time to go to seminary, I panicked. I didn't want to go. I didn't feel the calling to be a pastor.
Sure.
And I ended up, I already had my financial aid set up. I already had my roommate, and I took off. I went to Europe. I had read a book by Francis Schaeffer called Return to Reason. And when I finished the book, I turned the book over. This is before the internet, right?
Mm-hmm.
And on the back of the book, it talked about a school that he had started in Switzerland called the Libri Fellowship.
Right.
And it was a school for thinkers and philosophers from all faiths, though it was established by a Christian, to come and talk,
right,
to read the Bible, to think, to philosophize. And I'm like, if it's there, I'm going to find it. I bought an airplane ticket and a Eurail pass, and I found it in Switzerland. And I kind of set up my base there. I traveled around Europe for a year. And it was then I realized that my real passion was music, and I wanted to work in the music industry.
Right.
So what was happening in music at that time, in the mid-90s, was happening in Seattle.
Yeah.
That was the cutting-edge scene. I think Nirvana was really leading it.
Yeah.
Pearl Jam, of course,
right.
Was there. And so I left Geneva, Switzerland, and I moved to Seattle. And I did my best to get in the music industry there. I was there for 2 years, and I couldn't really get a foothold in the industry, but I did start a landscaping company and spread a lot of mulch.
You probably didn't have the right color flannel shirt.
Yeah, I had the Doc Martens, I had the flannel shirt, the army pants, I was there. But while I was there, I got a call from Michael W. Smith.
Just how? I mean, how did he know you?
There's a backstory. So the Michael W. Smith was a fan of the Good News Circle.
Oh, okay.
And when we would play Cerrito Canova, West Virginia, he would always come out. He's 10 years older than me. So when I was 5, he was 15. When I was 6, he was 16. And he loved the band. And as a teenager, every year when the band would be there, he would audition for this band.
But really?
You know, the music.
I thought he was kind of a dope smoker back then. Or
when he got into college, he smoked some weed.
Yeah. I mean, it's in his story. Nobody's saying anything. So at age 15, he was all on board for gospel-type music.
Yeah. But
and
he hung out.
Quite a talented musician, by the way. Great piano player,
yeah, and a great songwriter. And like we were talking about earlier, some people can hear original melodies in their head, and I believe this is a gift from God, that muse that just sets into them, and he is one of those people. He wrote great songs. So he used to hang out with me, and we would throw the Frisbee, and every time he would audition for the band, but at that time it was very sweet, melodic voices and four-part harmonies, and he has that gruff voice.
Yeah, kind of a gravelly sort of.
Pushes from his chest. Yeah, and it just didn't fit. He would bang away at the piano, but he was just a young man out of time. But his time came. He came up as Amy Grant's keyboard player.
Yeah.
Wrote Friends Are Friends Forever after his roommate took his own life. And then his own career launched.
Yeah, it did.
So,
Smitty.
So after that, as he grew, my dad went on to preach. He did less and less music and more speaking. He was an itinerant speaker. And whenever Michael W. Smith was in the Chicago area, he would always come to our home.
Wow.
And he would sit down at my mother's stand-up piano, and he would bang away. It was always out of tune. Yeah. And we would sing as a family, and he would hang out.
I don't know if he would. I know his dad played maybe semi-pro baseball in the Ashland, Kentucky, Canova, West Virginia area. And, you know, he's always, as I understand it, been very tied into baseball, which, of course, our son was a pitcher. So my wife is a big baseball fan. I'm a Cincinnati Reds fan, which is like being a stop clock. You're right once every 25 years. But anyway, so go ahead.
I mean, Michael is very passionate about many things. He is passionate about his faith. He is passionate about this country of ours. He is a patriot, and that is in his DNA. And he will talk about the blessing that it is to be an American anytime you talk to him. And he will also talk about his father. They have a great relationship, and I've always admired and respected that. But Michael W. Smith also loves teens, and he and I actually started a teen ministry. When I was in high school, he was at our house, and I came in, and I came in with my skateboard in my hand, and I had bangs down, you know, over one of my eyes, and he grabs a hold
great
of me,
look.
And he said, Chris, I want to ask you a question. He said, I've had this vision of starting a ministry to teenagers. He said, well, Chris, I love teens. Love them. They make my heart tick. That's Smitty right there. They make my heart tick. Love teens. But he asked me, as a teenager, if I made a club that would draw teens in, what would it have? And I'm like, well, it would have bands, you know, live music.
Sure.
Maybe break dancing. It would have a skateboard park.
Yeah.
You know, and
those are expensive.
And we had this conversation in high school. Then I went on to college. I traveled in Europe, moved out to Seattle. And during that time, my dad actually became Michael W. Smith's ghostwriter.
Okay.
And multiple books that Michael has were written with my father. And they were out in Bachelor's Gulch in Colorado.
I know where that place is.
Yeah, his place out there. And they were working on a book called A Time to Be Bold.
Right.
And at that time, I was living in Seattle, downtown. And in being down there, there are a lot of teenagers on the streets down there. A lot of them follow bands like the Grateful Dead. And they follow the band through the city. They come up or through the country. They come up through California into Oregon into Seattle, and their Volkswagen vans break down, and they end up in the street there.
Minute and a half.
And I started a ministry there to teens on the street.
Wow!
My dad told Michael about this, and Michael calls me, and he said, "Chris, I would love for you to come to Nashville. I'm ready to start a ministry for teens, the one we talked about 10 years ago." What do you think? Would you be interested in starting a ministry with me? He wanted to reach teenagers that would never darken the door of a church.
Did it happen?
And I said, I'm not interested in moving to Nashville. I just got to Seattle. This is where the scene is. And he said, well, I'm going to send the Lear up to SeaTac. Get it on it if you want to. And I'm like, a Lear? Yeah, I want to ride in a Lear.
Yeah, of course.
In a Lear, you get to look out the front window.
Tom, you were a little bit quick on the draw there, but we will take that opportunity to go to a break. We heard about the first part of Chris's mission in ministry, and in the second half of the hour, we're going to get to the smuggling part. So stay tuned. You won't want to miss it. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Just because we get around.
Talking about my generation.
Things they do look awful.
Talking about my generation.
I hope I die before I get old.
Talking about my generation.
Take my generation. Take my generation, baby. Why don't you all fade away?
Talking about my generation.
Don't try and dig what we all say. Big sensation.
My generation.
Welcome back to the Tom Dupree Show. This week, joining us, Christopher Larkin, who is a professed Bible smuggler. So
it's true.
In this segment, we're actually going to get to that part of the story after we finish up a little more about his music career. So here's our host, Tom Dupree.
Okay, Chris, let's pick it up where we left off. You were moving to Nashville to work with Michael W. Smith, also known as Smitty, probably one of the leading guys in the in gospel, contemporary gospel music in the last, 30 years. So let's take it from there.
Michael and I ended up starting a club together for teenagers. It was called Rocket Town. Originally, it was called Ground Zero, and then 9/11 happened.
No.
And we, and we immediately changed the name to Rocket Town, which was one of his songs off the Big Picture album, a song that he's really known for. A song about Jesus reaching out, not to the church, but to the unchurched. And we got in there and we started ministering, and we brought bands in, Christian bands and secular bands, to attract the teenagers. And then we just had a staff there that was on fire for Christ, ready to share his love, ready to disciple these young people, to mentor them. And we started stealing them out of hell.
Yeah,
and that's just it. So every Wednesday night we had a writer's night, which was really like my least favorite night because everybody in Nashville plays guitar. Everybody is a singer,
sort of a Bluebird Cafe kind of deal.
Very similar, coffee shop like that.
Come in and play your stuff, and kind of thing.
But I would go in and I would, you know, start the DAT recorder, set up the mic and everything. Yeah. I'd grab a cup of coffee and I'd walk out. But one night this young singer came in and he started singing and had the most beautiful voice I had ever heard. And I stuck around to hear his set and went up and talked to him afterwards. And I said, will you teach me how to play that song? And as it turned out, he is an idiot savant, or really? I should just say a savant. He can just play guitar and he can hear the music and he can play it, but he can't teach it. So what ended up happening was I said,
can't tell you how he's doing it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I would watch his fingers and he taught me to play his songs. And then I would take those chord progressions and write my own lyrics to it.
There you go.
And we, like my dad's band, we added a percussionist, we added a lead guitar.
Really?
And we just started playing coffee shops and a following started. Then we started playing bars. And then we started playing clubs and venues. And we just kept growing, summer festivals to stadiums.
Yeah.
But at that time, the biggest thing that was happening in music was Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera. Sure. Nobody was looking for a band with four dudes in it, you know? We had musical influences like The Who. In fact, when you were playing that, I was just dreaming of being on a Vespa and whipping through the streets of London.
That's it.
In black and white. And that was us. We would just get out there and rock. We would put our emotions into four chords and the truth. And quite quickly, we had several offers from the Christian music industry. And that was exciting at first. We thought, oh my goodness, we could actually make a living playing music. We could quit our jobs at restaurants and play music for a living. And three of the four guys were believers.
Uh-huh.
And we talked about it. We prayed about it. And we decided that that wasn't our calling. We weren't supposed to go into the Christian music industry. We weren't supposed to write music for the church.
Yeah.
And we slugged it out in the clubs for another 4 or 5 years.
Wow.
Before,
I mean, were you making a living at this, or
I was still working at Rocket Town doing that ministry on the weekends, and then I was traveling, and we built a following in all the universities in the South, based in Nashville.
Really?
Yep.
Well, would you play at like fraternity houses and stuff?
A lot of fraternity parties.
Yeah.
Yep. Or the clubs in that area. Sure, we would often go to the bookstore and play an acoustic set, you know, in the afternoon, and then play the club that night. But we built a following that was impressive, and we started setting up showcases in Nashville, and we brought every single label out to see us, and every single label passed on us because they were looking for a hot blonde girl and not four ugly guys.
Yeah, right.
And we ended up getting signed to MCA, Universal MCA, out of Santa Monica, California. They brought us out, put us up at the Standard, and we played Hollywood for months, playing clubs where Guns N' Roses had played.
Wow.
And we were on that stage, and the music grew. But this was an interesting era in music. We signed our record deal, a multi-million dollar record deal, in 2001 and hit the road. And we had Blink 182 on the label. We had Mary J. Blige on the label. And Blink 182 was going to put out an album in the first quarter. And they said, we're going to take the proceeds from that and we're going to push the new bands. We're going to push Atticus Fault. Well, what happened was Blink 182 broke up and there was no money. So they said, buy a van, buy a trailer, get out there and hit those clubs. And that's what we did. We played about 250 dates a year. Just on the road, living in hotels all the time. And they're like, we have Mary J. Blige to bail us out in the fourth quarter. And Mary J. Blige didn't do a Christmas album.
Oh,
and the label started to collapse. And we were.
They say she's unbelievable live, that she's very self-revealing and an incredible live performer. I don't know if she's still doing it, but anyway, go ahead.
We signed this record deal. They pressed 20,000 units of our first album in the year that Napster changes everything about how the music industry works.
Yeah.
And that year, 2001, nobody ever bought a CD again.
Yeah.
It was over. And the record labels weren't ready for it.
Yeah.
And they didn't know what to do. They couldn't push us. And so we ended up going out on our own. We became independent for a while. And then David Geffen out of New York signed us there. We had a video.
The $6 billion man.
Yeah. He had Alicia Keys at the time.
Yeah. So the label he's had strong. Everybody all the way back to Joni Mitchell and before that. Yeah. You know, David Geffen is the guy. But anyway. Yeah.
So I'm up on stage in Nashville playing the Exit Inn. And if I can be totally transparent, the night before this show that I had, I had played a small show and I got drunk and I drove myself home. And I fell asleep in my driveway in the driver's seat with my guitars in the back seat. And someone robbed me while I was asleep in the driver's seat, pulled my guitars out of there. And I woke up. I had a show that night. I was panicking. I needed a bass. And I couldn't afford a bass. And I ended up going to a music store that was going out of business. I went down in the basement. And I found this old Gibson SG EBO with the devil horns, that cool-looking bass. And I had it strung, and it was just a Frankenstein ugly thing. And I got up on stage, and I played that night. Mm-hmm. Well, Gibson Guitar had just moved to Nashville, Tennessee.
Right.
They just moved their headquarters. And
that's
Gibson right. sent somebody out to talk to our guitar player about a Gibson endorsement.
Wow.
But the rep gets there from Gibson. He sees me playing this cool old EBO, and he comes up to me afterward, and he says, Gibson wants to talk to you. We want to invite you out. We want to give you an endorsement. We want to walk you around the headquarters. And I'm like, great. He said, when can you do it? And I'm like, let's set it up for tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I went out there, and at the time, I didn't know that they meant it for, you know, my buddy, our lead guitar player. But I went out there, and they let me pick out the pieces of wood. First, they let me sort of participate in the design of what my original guitar would
sure.
be. I got to pick out the blocks of wood and hand them to the artist that was going to make this guitar for me. I loved Nikki Sixx's Thunderbird, so it was a replica of the Thunderbird.
Right.
But I'm talking to the guy who was about to make my guitar, and I'm watching this craftsman manipulate this wood. And I said, how did you learn these skills? And he said, to be honest, my dad was a Bible smuggler. And I grew up making these hidden compartments in box trucks, in panel trucks, that you could only open with magnets. They were completely seamless. And learning to manipulate wood that way without seams gave me the skills to make guitars at this level. And something about that, something about Bible smuggling resonated with me in that moment. And all of a sudden, everything that I was doing in music, this dream that I had of being a rock star, of being the next Bono, suddenly became replaced by this idea that there were people around the world that didn't know Jesus, isolated in these parts of the world that couldn't receive the gospel, places that missionaries couldn't go, places where it was illegal to have Bibles, closed countries like North Korea, tough countries like Afghanistan. And I thought, I need to be a part of this. Long story short, I joined an organization based out of Hong Kong. It
just all of a sudden, this music thing was just a lead-in to meeting this guy who made guitars and figuring out, this is crazy. It doesn't even make sense what you're saying, but it's kind of the way God works.
I'm an artist.
Yeah.
Give me a pen and I'm going to draw. Give me a paintbrush and I'm going to paint. Give me an instrument and I'm going to make some music out of it. I'm always going to be that way. But there's right. something that I'm more passionate about. And this resonated with that passion. I grew up in a Baptist church. We had missionaries in our church all the time. You know, I had that in my DNA already. But I knew I wanted to be a part of this. And I did some research, and I networked, and I found this organization in Hong Kong that smuggled Bibles into Asia. And I went through a program called The Art of Being Invisible. And I got trained to do this, how to cross through borders without being detected, how to move things across borders. And I did this for a couple years before I was contacted by the organization that I'm with currently. I was contacted by a headhunter, And they said, there's an organization here in the United States that is interested in your particular set of skills. Would you like to talk to them? And that's how I ended up here.
Okay. So we know that when you're doing this, there's a lot of forces arrayed against you being successful at your mission. My guess is there's an element, to what you do, similar to the way maybe the SEALs operate. It's covert in a sense. They come in to do something in the dark of the night, and then they're gone before you know they were there, kind of thing. Is that an apt comparison or not?
Yeah, I like that idea that we're the special forces of the church.
That's kind of right.
We go where no one else wants to go.
Sure.
I was in Hong Kong to do this training. I had paid my own way over there. I had used a network of people to get to this gentleman who was supposed to train me. And I get on a train. I go to the northernmost part of China. Or of Hong Kong to train and to do this, and
like you had to go through doors and stuff. It wasn't out in the open.
No, it's a very hidden, very secretive area. And when I walked through this door and these resources and these people were revealed to me, I was in shock that it's hiding in plain sight. And I walked up to this gentleman and I said, "Hi, I'm a friend of David's. He gave me this endorsement, set up this meeting," and the guy looks at me, and with a thick Irish accent, he said, "Oh, you're an American. I don't like to train Americans." And I said, "Sir, I paid my way over here. I've been waiting for a year to do this. I feel like God has a calling on my life. Please, will you teach me how to do this?" And he said, "I don't like to train Americans because Americans are too talkative, and you seem like a really talkative American." He said, "If you go in onto the continent of China, you will make me a promise. I will train you how to do this. But when you're there, you will never open your mouth when you're on the other side of that border. Can you promise me that?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll promise you." And they took away my phone and they gave me this old Nokia, analog phone, and
almost like a burner.
Yeah, exactly. And I ran about 3 trips a day for a week. And I kept my promise. When I would meet my contact on the other side, I would walk up to this vending machine, and I would get a Coca-Cola out, and I would take that red can, and I would set it up on top of the vending machine, and that's the flag. Somebody's looking for that Coke can up there. Sure. And they came, and they touched me in the small of the back, and I would walk to a cab, and they would help me pick up these suitcases. Suitcases loaded with Bibles are about 200, 250 pounds apiece. Wow. And I had 2 of them with a backpack on my back. We had to make sure that they looked light. And we went downtown Shenzhen and to the finance district, went into a building, nondescript, up in an elevator, 23rd floor, got out. There's a receptionist, there's fish tanks, there's magazines, just looked like an office. But when you push past the receptionist, where the offices would be, there are Bibles and Christian literature in all of these different languages stacked from the floor to the ceiling. And there was a couple there who helped me unpack all of these each day, 3 trips a day. I actually got stopped once leaving the continent, going the other way, and I had 3 suitcases, and they were all empty, which looked really suspicious.
Was there ever a time when you thought, "I'm dead"?
I've been detained twice. And no, I never thought that I was dead. I don't think that they would harm an American, but I thought that I could be banned from China and never be allowed back in. Yeah. I could be on that list. But I kept my promise that I made to this guy. Each day, in silence, I would deliver these Bibles and go back across the border with these empty suitcases until the very last day, and I broke my promise. I'm standing in this room with the empty suitcases looking at this man and woman. And I said, I said, "Do you speak English?" And they said, "Yeah, we speak English." And I said, "Will you pray with me?" I said, "I've been praying over these Bibles, and I've been thinking about the people who are going to carry them into much more dangerous places, who are going to take far greater risks than I am. Will you pray with me?" And my intention then was to pray for them and to pray for the families and people who would be receiving these Bibles. But this couple comes over to me. I got down on my knees, which felt right to me. And they put their hands on my shoulders and they prayed a prayer for me that I will never forget. They prayed for persecution to come into my life. This man touched me and he said, Lord, bring a challenge into Chris's life that he can't solve with the credit card in his pocket, that he can't solve through his family's contacts and money. Put him in a situation where he has to rely on you. Put him in a situation where he has to pray with faith and answer his prayer, ignite his faith, and may he go back into his church and reignite the flame in the American church. And I was in shock. I didn't anticipate that. And I got on the plane the next morning, and I didn't watch movies. I didn't listen to music. That I just had that prayer rattling around in my head, and I knew that God was going to use me in a more judicious way for the rest of my life. And about a month later, I get a call from this organization that I'm working with, and they said, we know who you are. We're interested in hiring you to do this for us. Would you come and talk to us? And I flew out to their headquarters. I met with their CEO. I heard the vision. I saw what they did. And I said, this is the point of the spear. This is the cutting edge of what's happening in Christianity. I want to be a part of this.
If anything you've heard today makes you want to know more, we can't put it out there, but you can contact us. Send me an email, tdupree@dupreefinancial.com, if you'd like to perhaps be a part of support of this organization.
I want to get to this before we run out of time.
We got 3 minutes.
When I started working for this organization, prayer created a paradox for me. I was training for a project that was happening in Iran, and I was talking to a guy who's been with this organization for 40 years, and Iran was the country he worked in primarily. And he had been smuggling Bibles into that country, working with Christian organizations, secret, hidden, underground churches there. He smuggled in a printing press piece by piece and a guy to assemble it. And that guy knew that at some point he was going to go to prison, but he was going to try to do a run of 5,000 Bibles and get them out. And he got past 5 and he went 6,000, 7,000, 8,000, 10,000. And then one of his neighbors or someone who knew him turned him in, and he went to prison. And when he went to prison and his staff went to prison, they hung him upside down by his ankles and they beat him with sticks. And as my friend is telling me this story, I'm an empath. I started to cry. And when I cried, I prayed. When I was troubled, I prayed. And I said, God, stop this. Stop this immediately. I think about Christians around the world as my brothers and sisters. When one part of the body suffers, the whole body suffers. And I said, God, stop this immediately, I prayed. And my friend looked at me and he goes, man, you're praying wrong. Don't pray for that. He said, Chris, pray that God gives you an understanding of what he is doing around the world. He said, right now in Iran, Christianity is spreading faster than it is anywhere else in the world. But it's not just spreading broadly. It's not just us adding to our numbers. It's going deep. And he said, I measure the depth of Christianity in two ways. The first is this: people know their Bibles. And he's told me a story about teenagers who were memorizing huge passages of the Bible, and they knew the Bible well enough that they could disciple. And he said, secondly, they're having miracles. When they pray, God answers those prayers. They pray with a faith that you don't see in the American church. And he said, do you have teenagers in your church memorizing the Bible, leading people to Christ? Are you guys praying and people are getting up out of wheelchairs? He told me a story about a little girl who had fallen into the fire and she had burns on over 80% of her body. And they didn't have a physician in that village. They had to wait 3 days for a physician to arrive there, and they had wrapped her in gauze and they had prayed over her. And when he arrived,
She was healed.
Well, that was a quick hour, wasn't it? It flies. It seems like we probably got another hour of content. So you might be hearing from Christopher Larkin again at some time in the future on our show. You've been listening to the Tom Dupree Show, and we appreciate it. We'll be back in just a few minutes with our financial guys, and we will be back in Lexington. So stay tuned.